Welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network's monthly podcast. I'm Naomi Fowler. If you're listening to this on iTunes, do us a favour, give us a nice review and click on 5 stars to recommend us. Coming up later.
It doesn't matter what the rules are if you put people in charge who are committed to not enforcing the rules.
A challenge to the US president and presidential candidates on restoring the rule of law to Wall Street from new group Bank Whistleblowers United. But first, here's a quick roundup of this month's tax justice news. The US election seems to be turning into the offshore election of all time, with pop-up anonymous shell companies funneling millions in political donations at unprecedented levels. Also in the States this month, 40 millionaires have asked New York to raise taxes on the wealthy. If you're a rich Canadian and don't want to pay your taxes, that's no problem for the Revenue Authority there, apparently, who secretly doled out amnesties for multi-millionaire clients of the accounting firm KPMG that got caught out. Well, it's not secret anymore because it was leaked. Seemingly, no legal repercussions for anyone involved. The ever-charming Switzerland's refused to give Argentinian judicial authorities information about Argentinian taxpayers with undeclared accounts there. In UK news, apparently Facebook got more money from UK tax authorities for its ads to get citizens to pay tax than it actually paid in tax that year. They paid a tiny £4,327 in corporation tax in 2014. That's around $6,000. Also in the UK, the Serious Fraud Office has ended its inquiry into massive foreign exchange fraud with no charges brought. In Australia this month, new disclosure laws mean the tax details of private companies with revenue of 200 million Aussie dollars or more have been made public by the tax office for the first time. And finally, just as this month's TaxCast came out, the EU Commission's long-awaited proposals on public country-by-country reporting for multinational companies were leaked. Country-by-country reporting should mean nations can make sure corporations are paying the taxes they should by getting them to report on the actual business they do, staff they employ, and profits they make in each jurisdiction they do business. But after some heavy lobbying, only tax authorities would have access to this information, so it wouldn't be public. The country-by-country reporting rules would be limited to activities within Europe, so no transparency on profit shifting to non-EU tax havens like the Cayman Islands and Bermuda. Firms could continue to lump all their profits in non-EU countries into one big sum. Great for them, terrible for poorer nations. In fact, much of these proposals miss the entire original point of country-by-country reporting. Apparently, the United States may be threatening legal action. But 10 years on into this campaign, the debate's no longer about whether big companies should report on a country-by-country basis, but how they should do it. Clearly, there's some more educating needed for the Commission to come up with proposals that are in the interests of citizens everywhere. Those are the news headlines. Time to talk to John Christensen now of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, it's fascinating what you discover, isn't it, through a bit of transparency. A couple of years ago, a European Union law was passed requiring banks to disclose basic information on their activities. The taxes they pay in each country they operate, all the sorts of things they don't really want to tell us. France was the first country to have implemented this into their national legislation. And the first results are out on the nature of the sort of business that banks do. And it's not a huge surprise to learn that tax havens are really key to their profits.
Oh, mais pas du tout. No surprise at all. Look, and this follows on something called the Capital Requirements Directive number 4, CRD 4, which requires all banks operating not just in France but across the whole of the European Union now to report annually on their profits, on their taxes paid, on subsidies received. So this is a move towards country-by-country reporting in the context of single-sector banking. This is the first time where we can really see whether country-by-country reporting reveals information that's useful to us, and clearly it does. Now, what's happened is that our colleagues at Oxfam France and CCFD, Terre Solidaire and Secours Catholique Caritas, have produced a report looking at just 5 of the bigger French banks. And what they find is that between them, these 5 banks have 16 tax haven-based subsidiaries which employ no staff whatsoever and yet are mysteriously generating $45 million in profit just in 2014 alone, the first year of reporting. So, as you say, fascinating what a bit of transparency shows up. Activities like portfolio management, derivative-based structured finance, the very high profit stuff is being shuffled off to tax havens, where, of course, they're paying much, much less tax. Kel Supries.
Okay, and it's interesting because the European Commission is proposing legislation to extend public country-by-country reporting to other business sectors. But apparently they're not very likely to go for full tax transparency. They're planning to restrict this reporting to subsidiaries in the EU. What does that mean?
This is my general concern. We're seeing powerful regions like the European Union take steps to protect their own interests, but they're not taking steps to protect the interests of third-party countries, particularly weaker countries. And I think this will lead to more tax wars, to this, the idea that it's our job to look after ourselves, but not to help other countries look after their interests. And there's a grave danger here, because then the powerful countries will prevail. The less politically powerful countries will not be able to get a fair share.
And so if you're a company and you're seeing that you don't have to do country-by-country reporting for subsidiaries outside the EU, what would you do?
Well, it might well encourage you to, as they're doing no doubt at the moment, to continue to use tax havens to shift all your profits from those subsidiaries outside the European Union to tax havens. And there'll be no pressure coming from powerful countries or powerful regions to adopt a more global approach to country-by-country reporting.
So when are they going to make a decision about exactly how they're going to go ahead with country-by-country reporting?
They seem to be kicking the can down the road a little bit, which is no doubt because there are some countries that are championing full public disclosure and some countries which are clearly resisting. Ireland is resisting, Luxembourg, Netherlands, and I understand Britain as well.
Watch this space. Right. Indonesia. They're contemplating a tax amnesty, expected to announce a bit more on it next month. An interesting proposal, immunity from prosecution and a tax rate of 1% for people who declare their offshored wealth quickly. I'm not sure how many parliamentarians stand to gain from this policy, but there's something else going on here as well, isn't there? Because coming along quite soon is the OECD's Common Reporting Standard, far from perfect, but it's coming to many countries near you. There's quite likely to be a bit of a wave of amnesties for tax cheaters. And one of the places that's agreed to participate in this transparency measure is Singapore, which, funnily enough, is where a lot of rich Indonesians like to stash their wealth. Where to start?
Well, you're absolutely right. This is only happening because of what's happening at the international level. Rich Indonesians have been using Singapore for decades. Best estimates are that something between $300 to $400 billion of personal assets of rich Indonesians are held in Singapore. Those rich people will probably be being told by their advisors, better do something fast. Now, tax amnesties are just such a feature of crony politics. They never succeed in what the politicians claim they're going to succeed is. We'll bring back the capital, it'll be invested, it'll pay its tax, and the lambs will lie down with the wolves and so on. It just doesn't happen. Italy should be held up as an example of a country which regularly has tax amnesties. Billions flood in and billions flood out immediately afterwards, and everyone who should have been paying tax for decades get away with tax evasion on a very, very low ticket. The low ticket in Indonesia is quite extraordinary. Absolutely no prosecution and a 1% tax rate. Oh boy, the rich tax evading Indonesians will be very happy indeed. So what should they be doing instead? They could launch a voluntary disclosure program, and let's say 25, 30% of the minimum tax rate. That's just on the principal, on the sum of money held of you know, the wealth tax, and then a full payment plus 50% of any tax due. Now that would send out a strong deterrent message. It's not as if the tools aren't there. They're going to be there in place very soon. Use those tools of automatic information exchange under the common reporting standards, and then apply really high custodial penalties, not just the evaders, Let's also penalise their advisers and float the possibility of banks losing their licence and law firms losing their licence where they give them professional advice to help their clients evade tax. This is theft. This is theft of public property. And those tax evaders who are caught, generally speaking, the richest and the most powerful, they should expect really strong sentences as a deterrent for others. Tax amnesties send out exactly the wrong message.
Right, because you get some people arguing for different rates of tax and justifying it that way. But one rule for the rich and another rule for everybody else can't ever be right. You tend to see a sort of an erosion of the rule of law in many other areas, a kind of mission creep. I think Berlusconi is a good example because he was kind of handing out tax amnesties like sweets before elections. That seems to ripple out to amnesties for houses built without permission, and of course you end up with him changing the law to suit himself when it looked like he couldn't avoid conviction, that anyone over 70 couldn't do any jail time. So, I mean, where does it end when you start to erode law and create special exceptions?
We all know that there is one law for the rich and another law for others, and a tax amnesty is just the politics of the past, the same old crony politics.
And in terms of the OECD's common reporting standard, this sort of new transparency measure, how long have the rich got to start putting their money somewhere else?
Some countries are going to be implementing it by 2016, end of 2016 to early 2017. It's there, it's taking off. It has a lot of weaknesses. It's particularly weak around disclosure of, you know, where legal entities like trusts are being used. It's also weak because there isn't a requirement for all tax haven countries to cooperate with all other countries, but it's imminent. It's a massive step in the right direction. It's to be welcomed. It needs to be refined, but it's certainly going to be worrying an awful lot of rich people and their advisors.
Perhaps we should do a little tally of how many tax amnesties we see between now and that time when the reporting standard comes in. Could be a bit depressing.
Oh, I don't even want to start on that one. We're also hearing that banks are going out there and they're marketing new services, particularly offshore trusts, to their clients. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's time to start targeting the banks, not just the bankers, but also the accounting firms and the lawyers who think it's their right to help their clients to break the law. These are criminals, and I'd love to see a few more bankers and a few more lawyers and a few accountants serving time in a prison near you.
Thanks, John. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. We forget history and its lessons so quickly. Time and time again, whistleblowers are our most valuable resource. But are we listening to them? Are you sitting comfortably? Once upon a time...
The United States had over 50 years of immense stability in banking with minimal failures. And this was the product of the regulations adopted out of the bitter experience with the Great Depression.
This is William Black, serial whistleblower, former senior US regulator, white-collar criminologist and associate professor of law and economics. That bitter experience with the Great Depression he's talking about led to good, solid legislation that protected the public from the banking sector. Things like the Glass-Steagall Act that separated commercial banking from riskier investment banking. But then this happened.
I have only one thing to say. You turn if you want to. The ladies not for turning.
And this happened.
I would like to have a crusade today to take government off the backs of the great people of this country. Less government and less taxes and more freedom for the people.
Bill Black.
And then they decided that really very substantial deregulation was the answer. And this set the scene for what's now been 30 years of successive crises, starting with the savings and loan debacle, the Enron era scandals, and of course the modern crisis.
The savings and loans scandal in the 1980s was 1/70th the size of the 2008 financial crisis. Just to put that into perspective.
The current crisis is going to cost the nation in lost GDP roughly 160 times more than the savings and loan debacle cost in terms of money from Treasury. So the savings and loan debacle was $150 billion in 1993 dollars. The current crisis is estimated to cost $24.3 trillion by economists. So this is just a spectacularly large number. When the savings and loan debacle started, people assumed that fraud had nothing to do with it. They used very similar language to what they're using now. It was just risk, right? Imprudent risk. People just got wild and crazy. And there were virtually no prosecutions, and there were virtually no serious enforcement actions, certainly not against anybody powerful.
But then Bill Black and his enforcers got busy. We'll have more about that in a minute. Just as with the savings and loan scandal, the 2008 financial crisis was also the result of serial fraud coming from the boardrooms down. Lehman Brothers and other banks were peddling a system of bad loans Bill Black maintains they knew could never be paid back. He calls them liar's loans, basically lending money to people without checking their income and ability to pay it back. Lending so much meant guaranteed record profits in the early years. They borrowed loads of money and grew very fast in what he calls a huge kind of Ponzi scheme. The CEOs got rich. Obviously, it couldn't last, but they didn't care, and the government didn't care about stopping them. Here's Bill Black giving testimony to the House Financial Services Committee a few years back.
Lehman was the leading purveyor of liar's loans in the world. Studies on liar's loans show incidents of fraud of 90%. When people cheat, you cannot, as a regulator, continue business as usual. Every day, the exposure of the American people to loss grew by hundreds of millions of dollars on average. All of the major regulatory agencies were complicit. We have a self-fulfilling policy of regulatory failure because of the leadership in this era. Well, what would you do as a regulator if you knew that one of the largest enterprises in the world, when the nation is on the brink of collapse, economic collapse, is engaged in fraud? Would you continue business as usual? That's what was done.
But during his time as a senior regulator, Bill Black certainly did not do business as usual. Despite limitations in terms of staff numbers, political will, he and his team cracked down on banks big time.
We made over 30,000 criminal referrals in just about the key 6 years of the crisis. And that turned out to be what was decisive in changing the FBI and the assistant U.S. attorneys, because we made public how many criminal referrals we had made. And so, you know, pretty soon there were 3,000 criminal referrals and only two cases being investigated or prosecuted by the Justice Department. And so reporters started every month to take our latest number and go to the Justice Department and say, okay, it's now up to 4,600 criminal referrals, and there are four cases. What in God's name is going on? The Justice Department got sick of being beaten over the head by the media.
So the Justice Department started to prosecute bankers by the hundreds.
They have the best criminal defense lawyers in the world. They will spend money like water to keep the CEO out of prison, especially because typically the bank will pay for that defense. And despite that, we got a 90% conviction rate. Collectively, just in cases designated as major by the Justice Department, we got over 1,000 felony convictions. We got over 800 of them sentenced to prison out of that. So it's the greatest success against elite white-collar criminals in history. And eventually, we had over 3,000 enforcement actions. And these were, you know, unlike the current slap on the wrist, these were really serious things where we were kicking people out of the industry forever. And of course, we were putting hundreds of institutions in receivership, removing entirely their senior management and putting new honest people in charge.
The Justice Department started to enjoy all the media attention because they were becoming national heroes for taking on the banks. And that made the politicians look bad.
Politicians rushed to give back their political contributions or to donate them to charity that they got from the worst frauds. And so the thing that had been the savings and loan fraudsters' most important weapon, the political contribution, to get that enormous help from these very senior folks, the politicians, suddenly became a liability. And it helped us because all of this moved the story from being a business story, stuck in the interior of the newspaper where no one read it, where the journalists were business journalists who were very hostile to the government and very positive to the crooks at first, and moved it instead, once the politicians attacked us, to the front pages. And then it was a political story, and it's a political story of, in essence, corruption. Powerful politicians coming after government officials who are simply trying to do their job and prevent these frauds.
But then this happened.
My fellow Americans, this victory was more than a victory of party. It was a victory for the people who work hard and play by the rules. A victory for the people who are ready to compete and win in the global economy, but who need a government that offers a hand up, not a hand out. That is what we offer, and that is what tomorrow we will begin to work to provide to all of you.
That's when President Clinton got elected. And President Clinton, of course, came in as the leader of the New Democrats. Any of your listeners who are familiar with New Labor under Tony Blair consciously modeled himself on the New Democrats. And they had a fierce ideological commitment to what we call the three Ds: deregulation, desupervision, and de facto decriminalization. So the regulation part, deregulation, everyone knows that, but the far more devastating thing is desupervision. Because it doesn't matter what the rules are if you put people in charge who are committed to not enforcing the rules. And that's what the Clinton administration, followed by the second President Bush, did. And they were actually quite explicit that they hated this intense supervision. They hated the enforcement actions. They hated the prosecutions. For their big strategic alliance was not with business in general, but finance in particular. Finance and high tech and Hollywood were the three big ones in terms of industry, but by far the biggest of them was finance. And indeed, finance funded pretty much entirely the New Democrats' superstructures, their organizations, which are called the Democratic Leadership Council. That was almost entirely funded by big finance.
The political influence of the big banks has escalated, so has their consolidation of the market. Back in the 1990s, the top four banks had a 15% market share. Now they have a 50% market share. Their lobbying power is huge. The House Financial Services Committee, you heard Bill Black giving his testimony to earlier, is the committee many politicians dream of getting onto. Big finance showers committee members with so many campaign donations they could take baths in it. So what would you do as a former senior regulator who's seen it all and whose warnings aren't being heard about what needs to be done to stop the next financial crisis and bring law and order back to Wall Street? Well, now Bill's got together with other whistleblowers and created Bank Whistleblowers United. So, Bill, you've set up Bank Whistleblowers United. Why now?
Because we've given up on everything else. We've tried and tried and tried for, decades, literally, to get these views across. I've testified 5 times in front of Congress. We're very experienced folks from banking and regulation. So we're going to try to go over the heads to the American people.
And you've put together a 60-day plan.
We have deliberately shaped it so that it requires no new legislation and no new regulations. So no candidate and no president of the United States, President Obama, could implement what we proposed immediately. But nobody can hide and say, well, hey, I would have loved to have done it, but the other party controlled Congress, so I couldn't get adopted. No, we picked things you can do entirely under your presidential power. And you can do them really quickly within 60 days. You can't hide anymore. Are you for restoring the rule of law or not? Are you for getting rid of the so-called too-big-to-fail institutions that pose a global systemic risk or not? Are you for stopping taking money from financial felons or not?
Right. And in challenging politicians not to take campaign donations from financial felons, you're talking about them rejecting big money from most of the big banks. Have you had any response yet from any of the candidates on whether they'd be willing to refuse those campaign contributions?
We have not had any official response, and this remains a major driver of the problem, these contributions. Both parties have been competing for laxity, and then there's been this enormous international competition where the City of London won the race to the bottom, and which is why the City of London is the financial cesspool of the world. But Wall Street was only edged out at the wire. So both of them ended up with almost a total destruction of effective regulation, effective supervision, and almost the complete death of any criminal responsibility for their actions. And the current crisis is in many ways the savings and loan crisis and aspects of the Enron era scandals replayed. We have bigger systemically dangerous institutions than before the crisis. Indeed, we can't even muster the honesty to call them systemically dangerous. They're actually called in the United States systemically important, like they should get a gold star.
It's not that legislation wouldn't be a good thing to have, but during Bill Black's time, public servants broke a raging fraud epidemic without it, since politicians wouldn't reform anything. The Bank Whistleblowers United 60-day plan is fast acting. They're proposing things like no more deferred prosecution agreements with elite white-collar criminals, reassigning 500 FBI agents to the white-collar crime section, employing thousands more enforcers and giving them more specialised training, stopping the revolving door conflict of interest problem with special contracts for new employees, honouring whistleblowers for their service to the nation, imposing minimum capital requirements on all systemically dangerous institutions, stopping the race to the bottom on regulation between nations, particularly the City of London, which seems to have won anyway when it comes to the facilitation of sleaze as active government policy. It's not rocket science.
We're trying to do three things. We're trying to get President Obama to adopt these reforms now, even though we think the chance of that closely approaches zero. We're trying to get candidates to adopt those principles and pledge they'll implement it. We think there's some chance Senator Sanders might do that. And if he were to do that, Hillary Clinton, we think there'd be an excellent chance she would sign on as well. But the third thing is, there was a famous investigation in the United States by Ferdinand Pecora in the Great Depression that led to the adoption of the Glass-Steagall legislation when he documented the fraud schemes. We want that done again, and no one has been willing to hold that kind of hearing in which we will look at 21 institutions, all of the which did these liar's loans, and examine whether they in fact were fraud schemes, as we believe. So we hope to take that on and show with a tiny, tiny, tiny group with no budget, with all of us having day jobs, that we can do more than the entire Justice Department and FBI have done in revealing the nature of these fraud epidemics. If you gain a competitive advantage by cheating, then markets become perverse and bad ethics drives good ethics out of the marketplace. But it hurts not only the consumer, but it hurts honest businesses. They are driven out of business. Then you are destroying your economy and your nation and producing not just crony capitalism, but inherently corrupt crony capitalism. It remains true as we speak that not a single banking leader of the three fraud epidemics that drove the U.S. financial crisis and much of the global financial crisis, has been prosecuted for leading those fraud schemes. Not one.
The last crisis still isn't over, and the next one is on its way. Because of banking fraud, millions of jobs were wiped out and people lost their homes. Government failed to re-regulate finance or even to ensure strong enforcement of the rules we still have. How much is the next crisis going to cost us if we don't reform political donations? In the United Kingdom recently, one senior regulator told Parliament he wasn't sure Britain would be able to foot the bill for bailouts for the next time. You can read more about Bank Whistleblowers United's 60-day plan on www.neweconomicperspectives.org. And at this critical moment in history, thousands have pledged to march and take part in a mass non-violent action in Washington in April, demanding an end to the corruption of big money in politics. It's called Democracy Spring. You can check that out on www.democracyspring.org. You've been listening to the Taxcast, and we'll be back next month.